Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Civil Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, April 21st, 2016, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on the Supreme Court's decision in Harris v. Arizona Independent Redistricting Commission. My name is Katie McClendon. I'm the Director of Publications at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also note that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today we welcome our expert, Hans von Spakovsky, Manager of the Election Law Reform Initiative and Senior Legal Fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Hans will give some opening remarks and then we'll open the floor for your questions. Thank you for speaking with us, Hans. The floor is yours.
Well, thank you, and welcome to all the Federalist Society listeners, people who've called in. We're here to talk about Harris versus Arizona Independent Redistricting Commission, a decision issued this week by the Supreme Court in a unanimous decision written by Justice Breyer. This Arizona Redistricting Commission was set up after an initiative was approved by voters in Arizona back in 2000. And it's interesting to note that this is actually the second case involving this redistricting commission as kind of a follow-up to a decision that was issued last year. And I wanted to just briefly mention that other case. As I said, the redistricting commission was set up as a result of a ballot initiative. So this was not approved by the state legislature. It was approved by voters in the state of Arizona. And the prior case that was decided by the court last year was Arizona State Legislature versus the Arizona Independent Redistricting Commission. And I have to say that that I think is one of the worst decisions by the court in recent memory in which they rewrote the plain terms of the Constitution. In fact, I was at a function last year at which Justice Antonin Scalia was speaking, and he in fact cited this particular case when someone asked him a question about one of the worst decisions he had experienced. And the reason for that was that the Constitution makes it very plain in the Elections Clause that redistricting authority is vested in, and the exact language in the Constitution is, the legislature, close quote, of each state. And yet, and what happened was the state legislature sued saying that their ability to redraw and redistrict could not be taken away from them through a ballot initiative. Unfortunately, a five-justice majority of the court said no, there was no problem with that initiative, and the way they did it was to reinterpret the word the legislature to mean the people. There was actually a great dissenting paragraph written by Justice Roberts in that, in which he talked about the fact that similar to this, you know, Arizona was the second state in the Union to ratify the 17th Amendment, which changed senators from being appointed by state legislatures to being elected by the people. And he pointed out that that amendment resulted from an arduous decades-long campaign in which reformers across the country worked hard. And he said this, he said, "What chumps? Didn't they realize that all they had to do was interpret the constitutional term the legislature to mean the people? The court today performs just such a magic trick with the Elections Clause." So that decision legitimated the Arizona Redistricting Commission last year. So the current case, Harris versus Arizona Independent Redistricting Commission, is over a state legislative redistricting plan that this commission had drawn up and put in place. After the 2010 census, they redrew the 30 state legislative districts in Arizona. And in order to do that, the commission, which is made up of two Democrats, two Republicans, and a chair who is supposedly an independent, they hired two counsels and they hired a host of consultants, including mapping specialists, a statistician, and a supposed expert on the Voting Rights Act. Using the 2010 census data, they came up with a plan initially that had a maximum population deviation of a little over 4%. Now, what the Supreme Court has said in prior cases when it comes to one person, one vote and equal protection under the 14th Amendment is that legislatures have to draw legislative districts with populations as equal as possible, particularly with regard to congressional districts. Even the slightest deviation, the court won't allow. When it comes to state legislative districts, the court has, through case law, given states kind of a grandfathered window of up to a 10% deviation. Now, what happened here, like I said, was the initial plan had a 4% deviation, but the consultant that they had hired to make sure they were in compliance with the Voting Rights Act told them that they should change that plan to be sure that they complied with the VRA and that the Justice Department would approve it. Because at the time, Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act was still in place. This is the provision that was basically tossed out by the Shelby County decision in 2013. At the time, however, any redistricting plan that the commission came up with would have to be submitted to the Justice Department, or they'd have to go to court in order to make sure that it met, excuse me, the legal standard under Section 5, which meant no retrogression in the ability of minority voters to elect their candidates of choice. What that means in practical terms is that, as it did in this case, if out of 30 districts in your benchmark or current plan, 10 of the districts are districts in which minority voters are a majority of the population, and therefore they have the ability to elect their candidates of choice, then when you draft up a new plan, you have to preserve the status quo. So the new plan would have to also have at least 10 districts in which minority voters have the ability to elect their candidates of choice. The only time that would change is if there have been big changes in population. So, for example, if the minority population of the state has gone down significantly and it's no longer possible to draw up 10 districts, well, then you could probably have gotten approval to do that under Section 5. But that often does not happen and hasn't really been a problem in too many cases. Anyway, after the VRA consultant told them he didn't think it was good enough yet, they adopted a revised plan that had double the deviations. The deviation went from a little over 4% to almost 9% deviation. They did this by changing some of the boundaries in some of the districts and taking, for example, a Republican-leaning district and changing it to a Democratic-leaning district. This did not get a unanimous vote. It was a vote of 3-2 by the commission, with the two Republican members dissenting from it. It was then submitted to the Justice Department for clearance under Section 5, and they pre-cleared the plan. The main crux of the lawsuit that was filed said that there was a violation of the Equal Protection Clause under the 14th Amendment because the Democratic-leaning districts were underpopulated and the Republican districts were overpopulated. Unfortunately, the three-judge panel ruled in favor of the commission, holding that the population deviations were primarily a result of good faith efforts to comply with the Voting Rights Act, even though partisanship played some role in what had happened. As I said, the court in the past has held that the 14th Amendment requires legislatures to make districts as equal as is practicable. But in determining what is practicable, the court has said that the Constitution permits deviations when it's justified by legitimate considerations. And legitimate considerations include compactness, contiguity, maintaining the integrity of a political subdivision, such as county lines or city lines, or the competitive balance among political parties. And before the Shelby County decision in 2013, the courts also said that compliance with Section 5, the retrogression standard, was also a legitimate consideration as long as race did not become the predominant factor in how lines were redistricted. In that case, you had a potential violation of a different part of the Voting Rights Act, Section 2, under a prior Supreme Court case called Shaw versus Reno. But like I said, this was a state legislative plan. And the court has said that if you have minor deviations in a state plan, that does not make out a prima facie case of invidious discrimination under Section 4. And they consider anything under 10% to be a minor deviation. So when the deviation is below that 10%, what plaintiffs have to show in order to be able to win their case is that it's more probable than not that the deviation of less than 10% reflects the predominance of illegitimate reapportionment factors rather than legitimate considerations. That can be very difficult to prove. And in this case, the court basically concluded that the plaintiffs had not met that burden. In fact, the court said at one point in the case that attacks on deviations under 10% will succeed only rarely in unusual cases, and therefore we are not surprised that the appellants have failed to meet their burden here. I mean, the main contention of the plaintiffs that the court said they couldn't prove was that the deviations were the results of the commission trying to help the Democratic Party as opposed to simply trying to comply with the Voting Rights Act. They also said that the variations may very well reflect the tendency of minority populations in Arizona to vote disproportionately for Democrats. The court specifically said that this was not the same as a prior decision, an important one called Cox versus Larios. And this, I think, was the case that the plaintiffs probably used as a model for this lawsuit that they filed. Cox versus Larios is a case that was decided by a district court down in Georgia. It went to the Court of Appeals where the decision was upheld. The Supreme Court refused to overturned it. And what happened in the Cox versus Larios case down in Georgia was that at the time after the 2000 census, the state legislature was controlled by the Democratic Party. And what they did when they redrew state legislative districts, both in the state House and state Senate, was that they systematically underpopulated the Democratic districts and systematically overpopulated the Republican districts. By doing that, it gave them the ability to control and have a larger number of Democratic districts and therefore be able to still have a majority of seats in the state House. The Supreme Court differentiated this case from the Larios case because it said in the Larios case, the court found that there wasn't any legitimate reason to explain the deviations in that case. And by the way, when they underpopulated the Democratic districts and overpopulated the Republican districts, they were very careful to stay underneath that 10% deviation grandfathering rule that the court has put in. But in the Larios case, the court found that the population deviation was not the result of any attempt to create districts that were compact or contiguous or to keep counties whole or to preserve the cores of prior districts. In fact, there wasn't any legitimate purposes like that that could explain them. In this case, there were legitimate reasons to explain the deviation, in this case, trying to comply with Section 5. And the court actually here says that even assuming without deciding that partisanship is an illegitimate redistricting factor, the appellants had not carried their burden of showing that it was a consideration. And so for that reason, it was a unanimous opinion against the plaintiffs. Now, the one thing that I would say about this case that you're not going to find in the opinion is that I happen to know who the consultant is that this commission hired to advise them on compliance with the Voting Rights Act, and who is the consultant who apparently told them that they needed to make further changes, the changes that changed the deviation from 4% to almost 9%, in order to get the Justice Department to provide preclearance. And I know this individual. I'm not going to name them. I worked with them for several years at the Justice Department, and this individual was, quite frankly, a very partisan individual, someone who I would have no doubt would want to be sure that the Democratic Party came out ahead in any kind of redistricting process. None of that is in the opinion because that didn't come out, but I know that simply from having worked with that particular individual. So I would have my doubts as to whether the opinions that were being given to the commission, how credible they were as to whether or not the department would need further deviations in order to approve it. The other problem, and quite apart from that, is the fact, and this is something the Supreme Court talks about, is the Justice Department, when Section 5 was in place, did not put up what the standards were for meeting the retrogression standard of Section 5. They did very complicated internal statistical analyses of past elections and how difficult or easy it was for candidates who are the choices of minority voters to get elected. And frankly, those analyses could come out very differently depending on what kind of parameters they put into it. And the result of that is that you never know really ahead of time whether the department believes that in order for you to have a legitimate majority-minority district, having a minority population of 50% plus one or 55% or 60% is going to be sufficient to meet their standards, because their standards seem to change and are not consistently the same. So that makes it extremely difficult for any state legislatures or any redistricting commission to come up with a plan that they know for sure was going to get preclearance. The end result of all of this is that I actually think the holding of this case was very narrow. I don't think it's going to have a lot of ramifications. They did not overturn the Cox versus Larios case, the case from 2004 back in Georgia. They simply said that in this particular case, the plaintiffs didn't bring forward enough evidence to show that illegitimate partisan considerations were the predominant factor in the redistricting. In fact, the factual findings were that no, it was compliance with Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. Now, since Section 5 is no longer around, that will make it more difficult in the future for the commissioners, certainly on the Arizona Independent Redistricting Commission, to use that same same reason for drawing up a new redistricting plan for the state that does the same thing as this one did, which was to underpopulate districts that tended to vote Democratic and to overpopulate districts that tended to vote Republican. And that is not that far in the future. You know, it's 2016. We will have the next census in 4 years. So basically within 5 to 6 years from now, state legislatures all over the country and these redistricting commissions will be engaged in this process all over again. And the ability to use Section 5 as an excuse for drawing districts that have this kind of large deviation, at least from a Section 5 standpoint, will no longer be there. So now I'll be happy to answer questions about the case.
Thank you, Hans. I'll now open the floor for audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then pound. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We'll answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, enter star, then pound. All right, we have a couple of questions coming up here, so we'll get right to our first caller.
Hi, this is Bill Hodes from Florida. I had just one thought when you mentioned that the motivation behind the consultant's advice was somewhat suspect, but you didn't want to mention the name of the person as a matter of comedy or collegiality or whatever. Why was that nonetheless not a matter of evidentiary proof? Couldn't the plaintiffs show this person's ties to the Democratic Party or do a survey of his take discovery to show what kind of advice he had given in the past?
I think that would have been very difficult to do. I know this from having worked with this individual for several years internally at the Justice Department. And, you know, none of that kind of information is discoverable. You know, it's covered by attorney work product and things like that. So I think it would have been very difficult to show this in a discovery mode. I mean, I just have to say I kind of rolled my eyes when I found out who the consultant was because of the fact that I knew them personally and had worked with them for years and saw the, some of the kind of bias I'm talking about in internal discussions at the Justice Department.
Go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Rod Sullivan, also from Florida. I have a more general question. What happens now in 2020/22? Is there no more preclearance required from the Department of Justice because Section 5 is no more? Do we just have a Section 2 cause of action, or are we going to continue to have the Justice Department say grace over the redistricting process?
No, Section 5 is gone unless Congress overturns Shelby County, and there are a number of bills that have been introduced in Congress that would do that. That would overturn Shelby County. That would bring back the preclearance requirement. In fact, several of those bills would make things even worse than they were before, putting in much tougher requirements. That is gone. So state legislatures will be able to do redistricting and draw new lines without having to get justice preclearance. Now, they are going to still have to comply with Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. And Section 2, you know, it's a very complicated statute, but it in essence bans any kind of discrimination in the voting context on the basis of race, and it particularly bans dilution of the votes of minority voters. And what that has meant in the past is courts looking at and plaintiffs bringing claims that they have not gotten...
Minority communities and things of that nature.
Yeah, that they haven't gotten enough representation, for example, in the state legislature. I mean, typical of this is a claim that was brought by Texas more than a decade ago where... there were two black majority-minority districts, and plaintiffs went to court claiming there should be four, given the number of black voters in the state. And that's the typical kind of Section 2 lawsuit.
But the non-retrogression principle is part of Section 5. Is that now non-retrogression no longer something that the state legislators need to pay attention to?
No, but they do have to pay attention to Section 2.
Okay. So as long as they're not splitting minority communities, they don't have to create a certain number of minority access or majority-minority districts anymore.
That's correct.
Good. Thank you.
We have one question pending, but Let me quickly announce that our next scheduled teleforum call will be tomorrow, Friday, April 22nd at 2 p.m. We'll host a conversation with David Rivkin and Andrew Grossman about regulatory considerations for new innovations in Bitcoin technology. You can find their recent white paper on that subject on our website under publications. Keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming teleforum calls, and you can consult the full schedule on our website, fedsoc.org. Let's go to our next caller, and I'll remind our listeners that if you want to ask a question, enter star, then pound.
Good afternoon, Mr. Von Spakovsky. I had a really quick question concerning the last caller's point and the point you made on Section 2 that's still in existence under the VRA. Are we to take from Justice Breyer's opinion that now that this 10% deviation has made these claims of potential voter dilution, or at least the inference of that, more insulated from challenge because that has more or less been ensconced now by this unanimous opinion? Or is that really anything that in practice will not have much effect?
I don't think this opinion is going to have that much effect. I think the problem here, if you want to know what this case means, the thing to do is to read this opinion and then go back and pull the case called Cox versus Larios, L-A-R-I-O-S, Cox being the former Secretary of State of Georgia. And what you'll see, the chief difference between these two cases was that in the prior case in Georgia, the plaintiffs just put up a lot more evidence of the illegitimate reasons that these population deviations occurred. I think the plaintiffs in this case simply didn't have enough evidence to meet the fairly high standard the Supreme Court has for you to be able to prove this kind of case. So I still think you can make this kind of claim, but you just got to realize that you've got a fairly high burden to meet. And I think if you compare the claims made by the plaintiffs in these two opinions, you'll see a real difference in why one was successful and why the other one was not successful.
But with all else being equal, assuming this identical case were to be brought under
right.
Justice Breyer's new opinion, say 10 or 2 years from now, assuming that's the case, then if the shoe were on the other foot and this was a Democratic motivated effort to undermine what a Republican legislature would have done, they would basically come up with the same end, because assuming, of course, it was below the 10% margin of deviation, even if they were to allege without any specific evidence an intentional effort to dilute minority votes.
Well, no, I mean, no, that's different. If you have an intentional, if you can show an intentional effort to dilute minority votes, then you're going into Section 2 territory, and you may have a very legitimate Section 2 lawsuit. Remember, Section 2 was not at issue in this case. It was the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, one person, one vote. And here, they weren't talking about racial considerations so much as illegitimate partisan considerations, you know, Democratic Party versus political party. That's very different than a case involving race discrimination, where the standards of evidence, frankly, are much lower.
Let's go to our next question.
Hi, this is Will Trackman at Littler Mendelson in Denver. Two terms ago, there was an opinion on the Alabama state legislature gerrymander, and it was the Republicans who were arguing that Section 5 was a compelling state interest as one reason why they drew the map that they did. It doesn't sound like the court in this case said that adhering to Section 5 is a compelling state interest. But it sounds like that might be one argument that other other map drawers might use. I know there's a North Carolina challenge pending. Are there other cases in which the argument that adhering to Section 5 was a compelling state interest and thus the map is legitimate may play out, or is this sort of a one-off type thing and that's not going to be relevant going forward?
The number of times it's going to be relevant is going to get fewer and fewer. There are still, I believe, a couple of cases pending involving redistricting plans that had to go through the Section 5 process, but are still being considered. And in fact, I believe one of them is there's currently a redistricting case before the U.S. Supreme Court out of Virginia involving Virginia's congressional districts. They've had oral arguments in the case. We are waiting for the opinion. And I believe, in fact, that redistricting plan did go through the Section 5 preclearance requirement. So in that case, actually, it is still a factor.
We have four more questions pending at this point. I'll remind our listeners that you press star and pound to ask a question, and we'll go to our next now.
Hi, my name is Deborah, and I live in a rural county in Washington State. And there's a dispute that's been brewing. Redistricting has just occurred here. Decision was just made yesterday. And my question has to do with the minority. Does race alone, is that specific, the specific criterion, or would rural versus urban? This redistricting was very specific to separating, newly separating an urban area, a large urban area, from the surrounding rural districts, and have any cases involved that sort of minority?
Well, yeah, in fact, while the Voting Rights Act is concerned with race in redistricting, the 14th Amendment, the Equal Protection Clause, under which the court came up with a one-person, one-vote standard, that is not based on race. That is based on the idea that the value of any particular person's vote should not be devalued or be of less weight than others. And in fact, the first opinions, the first court decisions by the U.S. Supreme Court back in the early 1960s, in which they established the one-person, one-vote standard, such as Reynolds v. Sims, those cases actually involved redistricting plans in states like Tennessee and Georgia, where the issue really was rural versus urban areas. And what had happened in those cases, and this is particularly true of the cases out of Alabama and Tennessee, is that in both of those states, the state legislatures had not redistricted and had not drawn up new plans for the state legislature since the 1900 census. And the reason for that was because of the demographic shift that had occurred over the past half century of people moving from rural to urban areas. In 1900, 1901, when they did the redistricting, because most people lived in rural areas in those states, rural counties gained control of the state legislatures. They did not want to redistrict in the 1950s, because if they had, because of the population shift from rural to urban areas, the rural areas would have lost control of the state legislature. And so they simply refused to do redistricting. So the cases that were filed, such as Reynolds v. Sims, were based on those facts. And that's where the court came up with the one person, one vote standard, said that these districts had to be redrawn so that they had equal population. And what happened was within 2 years, either both or at least one house of the state legislature had been redrawn in almost every state across the country. And there was a huge shift in political power from rural areas to urban areas.
Got it. And that was my understanding. A footnote here, in our area, the rural districts, when the 2010 census was when the 2010 census was conducted, the Census Department elected to model the census figures in the rural areas in this county, and they did not actually conduct a full census. In other words, only the urban areas filled out forms were, you know, subjected to census. I thought that was interesting where it comes to deviation.
Right.
I suppose we would want to look into what the deviation was in these models.
Yeah, I mean, that could be a possible factor in any kind of consideration of a lawsuit and what's going on.
We'll go to our next question.
This is Arthur Hillman in Pittsburgh. Hans, I'd like to pick up on the previous question about the relationship between partisanship and race. When you have Section 2 in the picture, is there still an opportunity, given the decision this week, to use, for either party, to use Section 2 to get in effect, a partisan gerrymander?
Well,
given the correlation that, as you mentioned, the court referred to in its opinion.
Right. No, in fact, that's one of the biggest problems today with the Voting Rights Act is that in recent decades it has come to be used as a partisan tool instead of what it was completely intended to do. I mean, look, the Voting Rights Act was passed, you know, probably one of the most effective laws ever passed by Congress to stop terrible discrimination that was going on, particularly in southern states in 1964-1965. And it was intended to ban racial discrimination in the voting context. The problem is that, look, that kind of discrimination has virtually disappeared. There's still isolated cases of it in some parts of the country, but it's virtually disappeared. I mean, it's so far gone that in the last 8 years, the Obama administration, which is not exactly shy about filing lawsuits, has, I think, filed only a total of 3 Section 2 lawsuits in 8 years. But today, because of the fact, for example, that African Americans vote for one particular political party upwards of you know, 95% and up, if a legislature is drawing up districts and they're trying to draw them up to, for example, make one district predominantly Democratic and another district predominantly Republican, that can be confused with, well, they're engaging in racial discrimination because of the fact that, you know, 96-97% of black voters are Democrats. And the Voting Rights Act was not meant to be a tool to be used by political parties, either one, for partisan political purposes. But because of how difficult it is sometimes to distinguish between race and party affiliation, I think it's now sometimes, the Voting Rights Act is sometimes being used in cases where there's no discrimination going on. It's purely partisan politics, and yet litigators and others see that they can try to use the Voting Rights Act to achieve a particular political objective that perhaps they couldn't obtain in the state legislature. And that's a misuse of the law and one that's increasingly difficult to deal with.
Do you think there's any way of, assuming Congress does rewrite the Voting Rights Act, do you see any way of dealing with that in legislation? It seems to me it would be extraordinarily difficult to write the law in a way that would allow only the legitimate.
I think it is difficult to do. I think the problem would get worse if they reauthorize Section 5. And the reason for that is that, look, with Section 2, if you have a claim, you've got to go to court. The Justice Department or private party, they have to go to court and they have to prove discriminatory conduct. And they have to prove a whole host of factors to show that what you're really talking about is racial discrimination. The problem with Section 5 was there was no such burden. It was up to defendants, states, to prove their innocence. And in fact, the Justice Department could simply declare that you have violated Section 5, really on very little grounds, and then the state would be in the, like I said, in the position of trying to prove its innocence, which could be very difficult to do. So, you know, advantage of Section 2 over Section 5 is with Section 2, at least, you have the normal court process that you have for any other kind of claim of discrimination, and that's the way it should be. We had made an exception for Section 5 cases. The only kind of case of any kind in American jurisprudence where the burden of proof was not on the plaintiff bringing a claim, but the burden of proof was on the defendant.
Thanks, Hans.
Our next question.
I've got a question about an issue that was not raised by the plaintiffs in Harris, but nevertheless seemed to be sort of cryptically referenced by Justice Breyer in his opinion. When the commission in Arizona took its last step and created this 11th quasi-ability to elect district by changing some district lines in one particular part of the state of Arizona, it did so. It justified that change not only on compliance, attempting to comply with Section 5, but on one of the state redistricting criteria, which was competitiveness. And Justice Breyer noted that the Republican commissioners objected, saying you cannot selectively apply state criteria to one part of the state and not the rest of the state. And it's particularly important with competitiveness, because if you do that, you give one party the leg up and you can sign the other. If you don't look at all the other districts, you can sign the other party into sort of uncompetitive districts. It's almost like a Bush v. Gore issue in the context of a state redistricting. Do you think such an argument might have traction in a sort of future case?
Oh, yeah. No, I think that's actually an excellent point. I mean, I think that is a very good point. And I think, look, part of a plaintiff's case, as we know from reading this, is that you have to prove that they were using illegitimate factors in the redistricting process. And I think you can make a case of illegitimacy if you can show that they are using a factor which normally is legitimate, but they're only using it in selected parts of the state. That to me shows that they're using it in an illegitimate way. They're not doing it uniformly. And yeah, I think that raises a potential issue and a potential problem.
Thanks.
I'll remind our listeners to press star and then pound to ask a question. We have a couple more pending.
Hello, this is Bob Davis in Maine. Is it still possible for there to be an at-large election for members of Congress within a given state, or state legislatures for that matter? And if the state were, say, 30% minority, what case would they have, if any, for contesting the outcome of that?
Yeah, I think that the establishment of the one-person, one-vote standard by the Supreme Court in the early 1960s, and we should all, I want to be sure everybody understands, look, there's no such language as one person, one vote in the 14th Amendment. I mean, that standard is an artificial creation of the court. Plus, the passage of the Voting Rights Act, and particularly Section 2, and the concept of dilution of the right to vote, I think has virtually outlawed the ability to have an at-large district. In fact, you know, states no longer do that for state legislative seats, for congressional seats. There still are probably a handful of counties around the country that do at-large commissioner districts. Those get fewer and fewer all the time because as minority populations grow, they become targets of Section 2 lawsuits, and it's almost impossible for a county government or city government that wants to defend at-large seating, it's almost impossible for them to defend a case like that.
Let's go to our next question.
Yeah, Rod Sullivan in Florida again.
this is a more general question. Is there any more logic to the rule that congressional districts need to be exactly the same in population, whereas state districts can be off by up to 10%?
No, no. Again, that's a very good question. And again, that's just an artificial creation of the court. I mean, look, if the standard is one person, one vote, and you're not supposed to be devaluing the votes of one person over that of another, how are congressional districts different than state legislative districts? I mean, the only difference is that what the court says is that, well, states, when they're drawing up state legislative districts, should be able to apply legitimate factors like compactness and contiguity. Well, why doesn't that same rule apply to congressional districts within a state, which are also drawn up by the state legislature? There really, to me, isn't any logic for that differential, but it's one, again, the court just simply established it and said, well, that's the way we view the Constitution.
Okay, well, I thought so. I'm glad you straightened that out. That's all I've got.
I'll give a last call for questions. Press star and pound if you have one. And I'll remind our listeners that our next scheduled teleforum call will be tomorrow at 2 p.m., and it'll be about regulatory considerations for Bitcoin technology, and that you should go to our website, fedsoc.org, for more information on our teleforum calls. Hans, do you have any closing thoughts?
No, other than it's going to be very interesting to see what potentially happens between now and the election. There are a number of voting-related lawsuits in different places around the country going on, and some of them may get to the Supreme Court on emergency applications regarding preliminary injunctions or injunctions that were not issued. And we may have a very chaotic situation if we continue to have only 8 votes, because on many election issues, I tend to think we may have a 4-4 split.
On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank Hans von Spakovsky for joining us today. We welcome your feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Please join us for our next teleforum tomorrow at 2. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks, Hans.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.